This is Terry Gibson, April 9th, 1999. Paradise and Millennium.
Analyst in Tacoma, and he's spoken for the Society many times. I've always enjoyed his presentations. He's very lively, and we'll all be very engaged and throwing out our ideas tonight, I know. He has co-edited a book, and this is the book, Psyche and Family. Doug Beneke, our bookseller, has copies of this available out in the hallway. Without further ado, let's welcome Terry.
I think people get tired of listening. Sometimes they want to see as we go along. What I'm proposing that we do tonight, I'm going to give a thumbnail out tonight and actually start the model, and we'll finish it tomorrow. So hopefully those of you that are planning on being here tomorrow, that this will fit in. But it's also designed to be a freestanding piece tonight. The Paradise and Millennium, actually, Peter Elkin called me last year. Normally these days I'm not doing the assigned topic stuff. Peter said, well, we were thinking about Millennium, and I usually just say, well, I'm not doing Millennium this year. Because I don't want to do Millennium. And I said, I'll think about it for a couple of weeks. And I just usually do it. Usually when I'm jogging, like three or four times a week, something just pops up. And I kept thinking about Paradise. I don't know why, it's not like a neon sign. So I wrote and called Peter back and said, well, I can do something on Paradise and Millennium. I don't know what yet, but that kind of catches me. And so for a year, I've been thinking more about that, and it's become very hard. Hopefully we'll have some fun playing with that. The Paradise Millennium, a Jungian reflection on cinematic images of the perfection of soul in times of intense collective transition, which we are in. And like I say tonight, I want to do a model, an overview, and begin. The way I actually moved through this, I went back and reread primarily Dante. Who was around the last millennium? The next edition of Paradise. Dante's reflection. So I went back and reread Dante. I got a copy. It's on the bibliography that I'll show read it tonight and tomorrow. But Charlie Taylor from the New York Institute has a wonderful book out for the woman and family. It's a collection of, they have a brief kind of Jungian narrative, but it's basically images of the great artists who reflected on Dante over the last 800 years. So it's absolutely marvelous. Blake and contemporary Guizzo and Botticelli. It's just wonderful. This is called The Divine Comedy. It's a set of books. I read that. I looked at Dante. Looked at Milton. Paradise Lost. Paradise Found. Looked at Goethe. And they've informed me a lot about it. And then I went back and looked at images of Milton. I'm amazed at the correlation between the film is our most provocative art. It's where image really gets under the skin. I'm amazed at the nuance between these artistic images now, and this stuff that they wrote us in the last few years. So, tonight we'll look a little bit at heaven and paradise and the way our culture contaminates that. And then we'll start to go to hell tonight, and hopefully we'll finish going to hell tomorrow. Before dinner, I'm hoping to get hell done before dinner. And then we'll rest in purgatory for a couple hours, which is probably all we can bear, and hopefully lift ourselves out of purgatory by our dismissal time tomorrow. This kind of sounds as impossible. I heard this. This is a rumor I just heard. Sylvia Brett Ferrer did that book, The Son of the Gods. Well, I heard, that thing about Inanna being willing to descend and go into the earth and do their well, I heard, only in our culture would this happen. There were groups in California that took that book and had descent weekends where you could arrive on Friday night, become Inanna, descend and become Arashkigo, become twisting, rotting piece of meat with her. And then you could be transcended, transformed, all put together in my son. only her. So I propose to do the same thing that we're going to go to hell back. One day is 24 hours. But tonight, Paradise Lost and Found, and tomorrow, Paradise Lost in the morning, Paradise in the dark, the descent, the sense of exile. And I think we all have found that. And then the afternoon paradise found. Paradise and the light, the ascent, and what I'm calling homecoming.
And maybe to just kind of set the mood, I found this wonderful set of passages.
Louise Brunel, a famous European director, in his autobiography, in his last session, he calls it Swan Song. It's a man that worked provocatively with images all his life, and was agnostic, atheistic, but believed images yearned for something. He didn't know exactly what, but the big word was psychospheric content. And he says, according to the latest reports, we now have enough nuclear bombs not only to destroy all life on the planet, but also to blow the planet itself empty and cold out of its orbit altogether and into the immensity of the cosmic world. I find the possibility magnificent. In fact, I'm tempted to shout bravo, because from now on there can be no doubt that science is our enemy. She flatters our desires for omnipotence, desires that inevitably lead to our destruction. A recent poll that announced out of 700,000 highly qualified scientists now working around the world, 520,000 are now busy trying to streamline the means of our self-destruction, while only 180,000 are studying ways of keeping us alive. But can I think of Kosovo right now, with these words, this brain, all this fancy, great camps on one side and cruise missiles on the other. We're in the middle of this. It's this almost sense. The trumpets of the apocalypse have been sounding on our gates for years now, but we all stop up our ears. We do, however, have four horsemen. The horsemen of the apocalypse. Overpopulation, the leader, the one waving the black flag. Science, technology, and the media. All the other evils of the world are merely consequences. I'm not afraid to put the press in the front rank either. The last screenplay I worked on for a film I'll never make deals with the triple threat: science, terrorism, and the press. The three threats. The last, which is usually seen as a victory, a blessing, a right, is perhaps the most pernicious of all, because it feeds on what the other three horsemen leave behind. You just think about the anxious coverage of possible because of under 2 days that kind of feed these men feeding. The demographic explosion, on the other hand, strikes me so terrifyingly that I still dream of a cosmic catastrophe that would wipe out the full 3 billion of us. Of course, a disaster of this kind would make sense only if it were the result of a natural upheaval, an earthquake, for example, or a plague. I have great respect for these natural forces, whereas I can't endure the makers of petty disasters who bury us a little deeper every day in our communal grave while telling us, hypocrites that they are, how impossible it is. And then he says, listen, imaginatively speaking, in other words, the true friend, it's the only way they know how to fight back. Imaginatively speaking, all forms of life are equally valid. Even the fly, which seems to me as enigmatic and as admirable as the fairy. But now that I'm alone and old, I foresee only catastrophe. I know that old people always say that the sun was warmer when they were young, and I also realize how commonplace it is to announce the end of the world at the end of each millennium. Nonetheless, I think the entire century is moving towards some cataclysmic moment. Evil seems victorious at last. The forces of destruction have carried away. The human mind hasn't made any progress whatsoever for therapy. Perhaps it's even a great. We live in an age of frailty, fear, and morbidity, where all the kindness and intelligence come that can save us. What is all this kindness and intelligence? Even chance, it seems better. So, one way to start, a filmmaker experiences his life, imaginatively speaking, self-defense. An old man looking back and saying, he's frightened. So that's one voice.
And I thought I'd put another voice with somebody from Switzerland.
Not you, it's not from Kuznak, but it's a Swiss. The Post Intelligence, or headline, had elated balloon pilots, savor the magic word. You may have seen them. Cairo, the day after they flew into history with the first nonstop balloon trip around the world, Bertrand Picard and Brian Joel of Jones Strike yesterday to explain meaning of the voyage. And Picard's really interesting.
His grandfather invented the bathyscope, which allowed it to go down into the depths of the ocean, and was the same technology that allowed him to go up to 32,000 feet. And his father mapped oceanographic waves that he used to get the balloon around, the first of these multiple trials in the last 3 or 4 years. So it was a lineage journey in addition to being an individual, an ancestral journey on his end. After being 21 days dangling miles above the Earth in a small capsule, what a thing to do to get ready for the millennium. Let's dangle in a balloon 21 miles above the Earth. In a small capsule, they were entitled to some high-flown gravity. For Picard, the philosophical Swiss psychiatrist and Skinner of the line of adventures, the rigorous journey was a metaphor for life, about confronting the fear of the unknown and accepting forces that cannot be controlled. The trip had been set, Picard said, to show an ideal example of our place in nature. There is not nature on one side and human beings trying to make an advantage on the other to explain. There is no separation between technology and ecology. There is harmony. Very different worlds than the one. It was so absolutely beautiful, and this is something we want to share with you, the sense of beauty. For Jones, a no-nonsense British balloon pilot, the trip was the ultimate expression of his craft. He noted that the balloon circumnavigated the globe had been sought long since, before there were airplanes, and long after the feats of winged aviation had been accomplished. This is the ultimate challenge for a balloon pilot, he said. To anybody who would say it's frivolous, I would say you simply don't understand. Both balloonists appeared in good health, but tired. It had been a long day for Jones, 51-year-old grandfather, and Picard, a 41-year-old father and 3-year-old. The pair completed a full trip around the globe over Western Africa on Saturday and touched down early yesterday in the southwestern Egyptian desert. Steered by the winds to a remote area, they tried to set down on one of the few roads in southwestern Egypt. But when they hit the desert, ice that had formed during the crash, high-altitude flight broke free and the balloon bounced 500 feet in the air. It bounced again on the second approach and landed smoothly to a hard-to-reach plateau about 300 miles from Cairo. They tried to sleep while they waited for the rescue, but ice water dripped into the gondola kept the car awake. Both men washed their hair with leftover water from the trip and passed time contemplating the ancient desert in which their high-tech craft had deposited. Interesting to me that the desert is where people often go when they face a millennial era, the great contemplative. The rocky terrain rewarded their recovery, the plunder they were lifted. Describing their trip, we could see absolutely nothing on any horizon. It just seemed right now somehow that we had to collect our thoughts and get ourselves together as we waited for our rescue. It's incredible how well you can feel when you are in front of emptiness because you are really in front of yourself. The two felt pretty good about themselves also. The balloon crew withstood foul air at 45-degree temperatures in their sealed, pressurized cabins. Picard and Jones said they alternately shorted each other's spirits during the trip. They had a third passenger, a teddy bear named Sean, that had been given to them by an airplane crew member. Jones said the two never exchanged a crossword. Picard came to tears a couple of times as he met with reporters at an airbase immediately after their recovery. He would later describe their 21 days as paradise. Later described in 21 days. But noted that many of the countries they passed over were far from peaceful. It was really heartbreaking to think that while we were having so much pleasure, there were people suffering on the ground all below us. It was really breathtaking to think that while we were involved in this event, we could do something to help save something from the sense of beauty. Sign of their new celebrity, the pair faced a gauntlet of photographers and well-wishers as they entered the Imam Hotel in Cairo. With all the troubles in the world, Cosmo and such, there's a story people can really like. That's why we did this. He urged the Egyptian army to take another helicopter trip out to the desert where the Republic of Balloon and gondola. The land of the pyramids and the Sphinx, Picard noted that Egyptians are experts at recovering historic artifacts. Out there, he said, this way of life that brought beauty back to our heart. So two very different images of the condition we're in and what paradise means. And we're going to be playing with those. One's pretty hellish, and one's pretty paradise. One sees life as hopeless and chaotic and tending toward its own self-destruction. The other says, if we just get enough vision and perspective, we can bring the beauty and the good and the thing that's done. We're going to play with these two tensions over the next 24 hours and see where they lead us. I want to go quickly through some things. Those of you who have been here before know this about me, but I always want to make sure. Believe I'm an expert on film. I am a lover of film. I just hope we have a good time looking at images. I didn't consider myself a Jungian expert, but I'm a Jungian practitioner and analyst. More a lover of the Jungian mode. I don't think anybody really knows what it means to be Jungian, at least to all Jungians. I just think we're all here because we love image. And somehow we think the only way we're going to save our bacon is somehow grasping the image and holding it close to us. Not a saint or a spiritual expert, but I suffer more and more appreciative of the self or God or whatever you want to call it. Silent and quiet grace and all of its agony that we experience in our life. And my goals would be to awaken by looking at these images or quicken a love of true art and aesthetic experience, which I think is the most sacred. I think we're all hungry for the Lord's sacred. Everybody comes into analysis with me. When I was in my analysis for all those years, I was trying to find something about the Lord's sacred and all the chaos and catastrophe. To suggest a frame within which to receive art and film more consciously and transformationally, and to experience living image as the purest vessel of the spirit and the whole self, and to see film as our finest creator of image in this particular cultural moment. And philosophically, I've been having this kind of six-year model developing as I've been doing these workshops. I really want to suggest to you that film is the most readily available vehicle for either genuine escape or genuine therapeutic healing in our culture. And I do believe that cinema is the most widely attended cathedral and synagogue in our culture. So I just want to put that out. That it is the alive place of sacred energy. Was pretty dead in a lot of other places. And even Bruce Willis films are tricked, and they're all about finding the transformation of lost innocence and soul. All the pornographic documentary narrative shoot 'em up is about the recovery and transformation of lost innocence. Film is the fundamental communicator, educator, and translator of living myth in our culture. It's where we go to be educated about myth, and it's where people like Lou Well speak to us through myth about what is living and what isn't living and their concerns. Film is deeply sacramental and, like the sacraments, is enhanced and deepened by an attitude of conscious soulful perception. I really believe that's true. If you've not been here before, if I could provoke you into thinking differently about what you do when you go to Odeon Cinema Class and the kind of attitude you bring into the way you think about the experience. So imagine this might be a sacred experience more than just an escape and getting sticky coal syrup on the bottom of your feet at the end of the day. If you imagine something transformative happens, I will be pleased. Film-like analysis works through individuation by conscious, alchemical, symbolic interaction with the archetypal world of the psyche. It facilitates often rapid regression to early life damage and suggests repair opportunities. It's amazing. This medium is so powerful. A good film will take all of us, regardless of our politics, our IQ, our sociocultural background, and within 30 seconds, we'll have to suspend all belief in the resort of the community. And a really good film, we will be actually in a reverie for 2 hours in the morning of the tournament. They'll absolutely absorb us. And it's a really strange ritual to go in a cold and comfortable room with popcorn and strangers and people coughing and babies whining and have a transformative experience in the dark with these large and wide areas for the film. It's a profound place. Film is a cruise. It's as strange as analysis. Just going and sitting in a chair office with somebody and dropping into these references and not knowing how the world it happened. Analysts and the analysts don't really know how this thing happened. It just happened. If on the best of days, this rarely happens, time just blows by. And somehow, the lost self that so many years ago in our childhood and our culture remembered and created. And somehow, something of the beautiful and good. Film is a crucial medium of initiatory ritual and transformative experience. One of the few fully viable such precincts are Temenos left of. It's not by accident that there are road films over and over again. There are films that are going from east to west of the United States, or west to east, or from south to north. They're a missionary film, an outer geography. The film's trying to teach an uninitiated adult culture that doesn't know where to go for the soul, where you can go for the soul. For those 2 hours, we're taken on the moon, we're taken to hell, and we're given an opportunity to see good film. It's an initiatory meeting. For a culture where most of us were not initiated, and even how to find the soul. With great religious institutions don't work anymore, our families are shattered often, our parents don't have a clue. Well, they're good people, but they're as full of grief as we were. And we pass it on to the next generation. And film is dealing with that image of trying to find a way to encapsulate the soul and lead us to it because I knew that. Film is living soul experience, and therefore, if it is living soul experience, it really does. You need to become literate. You need to learn to read the film. And Jung said, well, Jung recovered for us. All you need is like, Jung just said it's in us, even if we don't know it. It's in the dreams, it's in the films, it's in the art. The Gnostic, alchemical, mythic, and mystical traditions, living traditions of the West and East, are alive, and you can enjoy this experience more if you become literate about this tradition. The film is teaching us how to become literate about it, more and more all the time. It was not a surprise to me, the enormous fascination of George Lucas' Star Wars culture, because it was initiatory training. Those films were his films, Gnostic and Alchemy. He was a good friend of Joe Campbell's. Or James Cameron's work. James Cameron, you know, was a good friend of Campbell's. His whole film career is about that time. The Titanic was a film about the diamond of the self. And Cameron knew that when he was creating. He was obsessed by it. The budget overran, he gave up his salary. They said, we're going to go broke on this. It was a $200 million it was a runaway budget. And he was so obsessed, he went to the company that built the original China in England. Put on his 3/4 full-size replica Titanic, and he had the same carpet weavers that wove the original thing. Weave the carpets, and they're going to sink the dam. They're going to destroy it. But he was obsessed because it was living still as an icon of process. That film's made more money than any other film in history. It's surprising. Well, I think it's because Cameron is a soul winner. Sees his text, and he's literate by the Gnostic, alchemical, mythical traditions, and he knows how to put it the only form that makes sense. We love stories. That's why you're into it. You've obviously seen that the film that the Toronto group did. What you all did, in fact, the exercise process 3 or 4 years ago, The Way of Dream. And they just had this idea of just going and interviewing people in Golden Gate Park and Central Park. And you have a group, and everybody loves to talk about their dreams. Story, they want to narrate something about their chemical, mystical, Gnostic self. They're fascinating people next to them. We're hungry, and we don't know how to put it together. Film is trying to instruct us. Film is the key holder of paradox of the opposites. All of the outer world film, no matter how great, be, or trivial, has inner significance. And all inner world film, no matter how high, how self-absorbed, has outer world implications. Film is paradoxical. We're going to see a wonderful paradoxical. I got 5, we nearly get to 1. Truly, that's great. The person who started with wonderful paradoxical film about Elephant. Film, most of all, is the respectful teller of story and the lover of mystery. And film, John Beebe, who's a man who's probably done the most to think and write about of all of us, says film is not a representation of the transcendent function. Beebe said we have these tensions between opposites. The whole goal is their attention without throwing bombs. In our National Security Council couldn't have been a budget. Broken down old men who can't bear attention. Couldn't bear attention 1 minute longer to break it by the go war. You can't bear the attention. And you kept saying over and over again that you can be sick and bear the attention and not go to sleep. The transcendent function will come. I lay you odds that you know that. But he seriously tried. Jerome Bernstein actually consulted with the defense department. He was a consultant in Mexico. And Jerome Bernstein says, what would it be like if before they did Kosovo, the president every day said, what do you all think? Well, we wouldn't go to war until all the Congress and all the defense council dreamed we were supposed to go to war. We do whatever you all dream about. I'd love to know what those men were dreaming about. What they're dreaming about now? What is Slobodan Milosevic dreaming about? Did anybody ever ask? Well, to do that, You have to bear the tension. You should stop being impulsive. Stay awake. Stay calm. And the right moment will come. Out of Chronos, the Greeks talked about this kind of driven chronological clock time or observing culture. You wait in the tension of chronological time, the tension between life and death, and heaven and hell, and male and female, and earth and sky. We have to bear those tensions. You know, we're the only species on the face of the earth, apparently, that knows they're going to die. That's a horrible tension. If you bear that, if you can bear it and stay awake, you don't say over and over, you can't guarantee it. Kairos comes. The sense of numinous life. And the transcendent function comes and gives a dream or suggests a way. But it's a mood that comes out of the body. You can just thought out of the river. I mean, so many American friends say out of the bowels. It's you. The body is a flavor and suggests action. It seems just. Film, most of all, is not a representation of that transcendent function. That it doesn't tell us what to do, but it's a vehicle for individuation. It's a vehicle to allow us to bear that tension so we can wait for the transcendent function or the soul of you. You know what I said? I'm just an empiricist. I'm not a theologian. I'm just a psychologist. I thought about God. I'm glad that God was talking about it. He was talking about this. You got to know that. You know exactly what he was talking about. And you, the ancient Christians, believe all of us have this scintilla, this splinter. We're all holograms. Whatever the divine intelligence that Dante will talk about, that wonderful cosmic rose of Beatrice standing beside you, saw all thousands of souls who love the good in this world gathered in a cosmic rose. And Dante, the pilgrim, guides Beatrice and Bernard. Helping get in virtual. And for those is he is God. Each of us carries a scintilla of that rose. It's the holographic candle for nature. And film allows us to realize what that point wants us to do if we can bear the tension to the film. The best directors and the hardest to bear, I always love one of the David Lynch films because half the audience sleeps halfway through. Disgusting. Lost Highway or Blue Velvet. Disgusting. Awful. Terrible. What is this? Sex, violence, darkness. Because it's the soul. David Lynch requires a specific intention of the opposite. While Dennis Hopper is down in a regressed childhood thing, screaming dirty words over and over again and asking for his love. David Lynch asks us to bear the tensions and understand that that's us. Bear that tension. If you bear the hell, maybe it will bear that. Film, so it's a vehicle for individuation, for spiritual direction, for educating ego to recognize the transcendent function and the visions of the self from the soul that it portrays. So enough said about that. Let's look at some film. Peter Weir. Mike, this director I first saw, how many saw The Last Wave? It's good we remember this before we see this film. It's Peter Weir's first big breakthrough in our culture. Last Wave, Richard Chamberlain plays an Australian attorney who gets an Aboriginal client. And he starts getting increasingly troubled. He thinks he's doing pro bono work. He's kind of irritated. But after a while, this strange man, who rumors are is an Aboriginal shaman, increasingly Richard Chamberlain enters the dream find. He doesn't know where his dream ends off and where he begins. And where the Aborigine ends and he begins. And at the end, we see Richard Chamberlain going deep down underneath our currency, descending into the darkness of our cities, the darkness of evil and despair and chaos through all cities, into an archetypal heritage, into the ancestral realm. At the end of the film, we don't know if it's a primal flood wave that comes. A flood wave that's in the inside, or if he's surviving outside. By the end of the film, Peter Weir, we don't know where the dream time is and where real time is. We need to let the study. About who's more real? The me that watched that film, or the me that's going out past the popcorn stand? So it was a great piece of film. And he's come back to us. In this millennial decade with the Truman Show. We're going to watch the Truman Show. that the church is. He's reflecting for us an image the way our culture wants to see it. All I'm going to set out where you're going to see this is, we just see this. Maybe you ever see a David Lynch film like Blue Velvet. You may remember the opening scene where it's like a child, it's just wonderful. There's a fireman going on in a fire truck. The fire truck is redder than red, and the grass is greener than green, white painted fence is whiter than white. It is the perfect paradise of the American sun. In slow motion, the fireman's waiting, the truck goes slow, and then we see what we later learn to be the father watering his lawn in his perfect paradise, and he suffers a coronary. And then we go down into the valley water hose, and suddenly we're down into the instinctual realm, and we come up to a dirty, rotten field. Suddenly, the French has had his confidence to have a couple of on the lawn. Well, Peter Weir is the same way. The film starts in a perfect place. There's some cross-cutting. What we are kind of gathering is that this perfect place has something to do with a non-stop television show. And there's a central person. We don't know if it's a person or a character. His name is Truman. And he lives in a perfect world. And Truman, every day, has a perfect life. He's a perfect wife. He's a perfect kind of suburban trophy wife. He's the perfect suburban trophy husband. They have the perfect mortgage, home in the suburbs, perfect lawn, perfect new car. Goes down a clean public square. Goes up every day. He goes to come to the usual rituals. He goes up every day and he buys women's magazines. Everybody knows. He buys women's magazines. Go get that. He always says, more than mine. For the wife. For the little woman. Not for me. I'm not a sissy. This is for the little woman. And he goes to his office. We get some kind of sense of his life. It's perfect. The Blue Darkness, he sent out to do a special assignment. He's supposed to go off. He discovered that he's living in a community that's a perfect island. Not only is it paradise, it's not paradise, but it's a suburban American island. And he discovered that he's supposed to go and do his business for his insurance company. And he gets out and he has a phobic attack. He sees a half sunken boat in a panic attack. He can't leave the island. And you start getting some dark. There's more going on here. And there's cutbacks. We see a man that later we discover is Christoph. And we discovered that Christoph is the director of this TV show that somehow Truman's involved in. And we get some kind of sense that Christoph made a script or something. We don't know exactly how. But we begin to get images that always got a perfect life, but this man is also Truman. You know how? We get to believe that maybe he's part of the television show. And we get more information. Maybe he was in that television show from the beginning, from birth. He was chosen as an orphan child that had no family. And he was going to be part of a non-stop television show that would run 24 hours a day with no commercials. It would be being familiar. And you know how they make the money? How do you start to make money in the show? Product placement. What we've discovered is the largest structure on the face of the earth, outside the Great Wall of China, that human beings ever created. They created this thing for all the terms of life. There is a sun. And Skycam in the sky is where Christoph directs and writes the script. But we're watching as the Truman character. Truman character, we don't know the Truman character was involved in the Truman, the human being. But we see him beginning to get reflective about his plight, his own thing. And where he is, kind of like he's here in Seattle, he and his best friend are out on a freeway that's just stopped. It's the freeway to nowhere, like I-90, just hung up there for years. It goes out to nowhere, and they go out and get golf balls out into the infinite, off the island. He goes out there with a case of beer and his buddy, and they share buddy secrets about it. It's going to be a long story. I'll be doing a show them get us into some of the motion of the Truman Show as Truman begins to think about his dilemma. Here he is having his anxiety attack.
Hey, me. help, sir. You go ahead, I'll be fine.
Walk away from our financial obligations?
Job.
I thought we're going to try for a baby. Isn't that enough of an adventure?
I can wait. I'm going to get away. See some of the world. Explore.
You want to be an explorer. This will pass. We all think like this now and then. Let's get you out of these wet clothes.
You never see anything anyway, though. Just turn the camera and play music, and you know, the wind blows in and the curtains move, and you don't see anything.
Doesn't sound insane at all to me. I see him 10 times a week in 100 different faces. I almost hugged a perfect stranger in the salon downstairs.
It was Dad. I swear, dressed like a homeless man. And you know what else was strange? A businessman and a woman with a little dog came out of nowhere and forced him onto a bus.
Well, it's about time they cleaned up the trash downtown before we become just like the rest of the country.
They never found Dad's body. Maybe somehow.
God,
I was telling you, if it wasn't him, it was his twin. Did Dad have a brother?
Truman, you know perfectly well that your father was an only child, just like you. Now, sweetie, you're just feeling bad because of what happened. You sailing off into that storm. But I never blamed you, Truman. And I don't blame you now.
What did you want?
I made macaroni. You know, you really ought to throw out that mower. Get one of those new Elk Rotors.
can remember asking us to bear the tensions of opposites. Peter Ware is really screwing around on that paradigm. Really. And you don't, you're kind of in on it and you're not in on it. Like that, most ways it's not. But the body looks sure enough. You'll have to put the circuit to a little fry. Yeah, it's not body. Saving, yes, yes. This film had a profound sinking and all the way through. You know, there's a lot of debate about how redemption begins. I think Peter Ware had grabbed his body state and living in his culture profoundly. And it is a very sinking thing. A lot of people are just pointing to the suffering and get away and talking about it. Despair, profound angst, despair, sadness.
You're leaning forward. There's a real feeling of pressure from the back end of your mind. Like, you want to dive into something and you're going to put that at the same time.
Well, of course, you want to do something. You want to get a clean breath of air. The body feels real and feels very something. Quality. So we're all living super. The body knows it's where we're living. Very empty world. Truman, the character, waking up inside Truman, the person, and the angst and the despair and the sense of loss. And knowing probably the only thing for it is Fiji, and how in the world are you going got fat and even more depressed than Cole Lamont's did. Didn't work for Brando. He tried. Brando maybe is less out of sea game than we are.
He was more of a register. I felt my look was that I felt earlier in time I had a chance to enter into the paradise. But I think he couldn't do it. There was no wall preventing him from doing it.
I think that is. I mean, what is real paradise? You may have been watched by the same going into this one. This is not real paradise. Don't get into it.
No, I think it's a certain amount of that takes our own lives. We need to feel like we need to search for some kind of ultimate reality.
Well, we're there. We're getting our lives together. You have been around before. I just have a simple model that I suggest you can do your own. This really works for me. If you imagine, if Jungian psychology kind of deals with a pyramid, what are we looking for? If the ego's up here, the part of us that goes on a Friday night to film, and it's this conscious part that lives in this kind of shopping mall culture bars. And the ego somehow wants to get through the personal unconscious, all that kind of personal childhood trauma and the trauma of living in the despair of this culture, and get into the archetypal realm that Jung used this language for persona and shadow and on spirit, quantum. But there's some kind of living scintilla in us of this thing we're looking for. The Vichy in us, the soul, the self. Amount of day and individuation, the process of getting from here to get the ego engaged with the soul, to somehow find the rhetoric and the vocabulary soul and the body experience of awakening. And the film is trying to individuate us a little bit in 2 hours. It's trying to move us towards an ego self axis connection with our own soul. Then, with every film, you might ask, first of all, where is the voice of ego? The voice of every man and every woman living in this culture. We've heard some of those voices. Despair, honest, loss, hopelessness, choking feeling the body. Where else did we see ego? The voice of consciousness disconnected from the lower realm of the spring and soul. Where else did we hear the voice of ego? What do you see? Where did Peter wear put the voice of ego? Oh, yes! Well, absolutely! People's way, looking at it on the surface. Well, that's on the greatest hits tape. You can see that. Maybe you can go by it when you get home, but that's ego. You know? Don't worry about that. We've captured it. We have the essence. Or a kind of romantic nostalgia. Oh, you know, I don't know why you ever got involved with Marilyn. Why didn't you find it? This is a kind of romantic, saccharine sort of tactics it. Where else did you hear?
Peter was talking to Randy about the voice of ego. And the pain that he goes in. Huh?
His friend. His friend and his wife. One of the great things is he discovered his wife. He's really an active prostitute. He's one. She gets bonus for sex. And his friends are paid friends. Talk about crude. And they believe they take pride in being a crack. I don't know if they're good at this. Well, you get his friend. Peter Weir is saying probably most of our relationship in prostitution is called Peter Weir's hand. Most of the time, all we give each other is the And we, the persona, we use each other. How many relationships are there really a little soul down? There's exposure moment that we need. And a real listening moment that we need. One of the reasons the analytical thing works, and it's a prostitution relationship. I'm a professional parent, people pay me a little bit. But that level is a bizarre thing. Hopefully, it has some genuineness about it. But it is, at other levels, it's a strange thing. People pay because they can't find real friends. Their spouse is really here listening, they're not really listening, their spouse is there. So they had to go to a paid profession to get something genuine out of the culture. Culture's so flat. You know what I mean? Genuine out of the culture. People want it. You know, there's some capital. Peter Weir does not condemn the wife. When you get along, there's no capital. Everybody's got a car. That's what the prison of the world is. Truman himself is the supreme ego who the script is saying, enjoy this. It's perfect. And you see Christoph character is one of the parties, was great, fucking great about what a creation he's made. And he's up there at the eye of the sky, Cam thing up in the ceiling with giant Truman gun. And he's got these high-tech headset with a voicemail and the voice mic. And they decide to reintroduce the plot and walk on the script. And they decide, well, let's take advantage of this. And Christoph's reading them their lines. And he's full of them. I heard that a little closer to him. And he was stuck with him. You're back. Oh, that's good. Oh, that good. He's giving instructions to bug and ear to the actor. And Truman cries his attention to the whole technical group. All of his turns. Oh. And Truman's a victim of that. And he's in it, but he's starting to wake up. Where else are
you? The way that the land, you're looking at a shot, the normal something like a circle that says you're really looking through the land.
Technology, they're doing well before one of the leading four horsemen, their technology. And Christoph tells us later on, he says, we just originally had one camera in the birth. We decided to keep watching. And now we have 5,000 cameras. Buried inside the dashboard, buried in the top of the stage. We have 5,000 cameras. We the technology, we have this man surrounded by them. We go to sleep with him and we wake up and Truman can't be so going to see. And so the eye of the camera can see something that is trying to see.
The proper approach is that you're believing because we have a brand of breath.
I was trained, when I went to training, the therapy training went to 10 out of different traditions. By the time I finally got there, there were one-way mirrors. So I got in medically back in the 50s, people were trained by one-way mirrors. There were new therapy people, and other people watching behind this one-way mirror. And it was eerie, because you could see people lighting their pipes and cigars. That's not very classic. That was way to train. And that was considered, by the time I got there, that it wasn't considered very good. They walled that off. That was kind of protected. That's kind of like perfect technological habitat. See, here is the perfect, the product placement.
Oh, you'd be better with one of those delivery companies. It slices and dices and Mother Hubbard's macaroni.
You know, just, and, you know, film can't be made. Peter Hurt, they can find himself. You know, some films, 80% of their budget is paid for now by product placement. They can't, they film is so expensive, they can't do it without it. And Peter Hurt had product placement. This stuff, he was paid to place the boards and stuff inside. It's not the irony. And one of them, they can't do it without it. But it's the bizarreness of the culture. The manipulation of the commercial and consumer. Well, that's the ego. So always, in the film, you might say, where is the voice of ego? And it's despair. It's false. It's always there. And pornography, documentaries, and narratives, and a Terminator 2, the voice of ego is there. Second thing is, where is the self and the soul? Let's say it looked like film. Try to say, where's the self and the soul? Where did you see the soul? What can he trust? I mean, something more, and for truth. And of course, listen, any true man, if you're aware of this, I don't know what to say, except and look at this thing. If you're aware, I'm sure it's been mud storyboard in this film. There's not an accidental frame. Not an accident. It's wholesome. But that box is inside the box. And he has memory there. Who does he most have memory? What does he most have memory inside the box? What is the impression of the soul? Well, Calvin, even more than that, is constant. And who is she? She's Beatrice. In this hell, she comes out, reaches out to him, she sees him. What they connect is, and she knows the truth. She knows it and knows it. She tries to bring the truth to him. And now, she's not just in the outer world, she's in my time. She's a mirror or a projection of the real soul that's inside him. It seems appropriate here, just thinking about mirroring of the eyes. Dante. And now, he's in Paradiso. He's finally got connected. Virgil's got him through hell and the purgatory. And you know, Beatrice was a real woman in Dante's life. He first saw her when she was 13 years old, crossing in front of us out of Palazzo Vecchio, anybody who's ever been in Florence. He really saw her and he became his heart. She became the one woman that was simple in his meditation for his life. He never had real contact with her. They spoke to her. She died young. And then, because he got involved in politics for good reasons, his involvement slowed down the most of the war he got his own when he was born. And what he did, he would have never loved his home, and he got into his grief and sorrow about that exile. And he wrote, when he wrote the Divine Comedy, he was talking about the hell of the exile. He could never get back to his home. His child would get back in the box. He could never get back to his child. And he hoped, he really believed by writing this poem, he could atone to God and let him get back. But let him get back to his home. The sad thing was that God never returned to him, never allowed him. And from Puerto Rico taxi, the last 13 conflicts were lost. And then the word he died, and he thought he didn't finish. His son, Jacobo, had a dream several years later of a house. The last 13 condos were inside the wall of his house that his father had stayed in exile. He went there and they took the floorboards out and found the bold manuscript for the last 13 condos. And in this condos, he says, and now behold another, the central of these splendors approached me, and its will to pleasure me. It signified by brightening outward. On me. The eyes of Beatrice were fastened were upon me as before a dear assent to my desire assurance gave to me that he is the real. This idea of the eyes, Sophia's eyes, are your room, President Room, looking for your face. At the same time, Dante is having this imagination in the middle of another veil that contained over the death of Chance. Started whirling, he got really nervous because he loved this man. It was an Eros, for good man, where the Eros is, Chance on him. He was in Greek. And we're told he began turning counterclockwise. That's why another dervish is turning. It's a way of reading and praying to transform the laws and remembering time. From the beginning of my life, I have been looking for your face, but today I can't see. And the truth, he's been looking for her face ever since he won. He's a peach. But today I can't see. Today I see the charm, the beauty, the unfathomable grace of the face that I was looking for. Today I found you, and those who laughed and scorned me yesterday are sorry, as they were not looking. Really tells him, God, he tells us that he vessels himself to really see the truth. I am bewildered by the magnificence of your beauty and wish to see you with 100 eyes. My heart is burned with passion and to search forever for this wondrous beauty that I now behold. I am ashamed to call this love human and afraid of God to call it divine. He said, I'm ashamed to call this love human because I don't want to profane it. But I'm also afraid to get arrogant to call it God, to call it divine. I want God to be awesome. But this is the love. This is the love. Your fragrant breath like morning breeze comes and spills in the garden. Your breeze invited to me. I have become your sunshine and also your shadow. My soul screams in essence. Every fiber of my being is in love with you. Your effulgence has lit a fire in my heart. And you've made me radiant. The earth and the sky are on fire. My arrow of love is alive and departed. I am the house of mercy. And my heart is the place of prayer. And as I have seen, the true man is praying. Many can have a true love. She is real life. I will give it away, but she is real life. Heaven help me. And the final thing is, what is the nature of the conflict between them? What central soul problem has to be resolved in the relationship between ego and self? What does Peter Weir say the central soul problem is to be solved, first of all? What's the problem between ego and the soul? What's the problem? What's preventing them getting together individually? What's the problem? What does Peter Weir say? What's the problem? But God is not. But clearly not. He is gnostically, alchemically, mystically literate. Peter Weir has done his homework, and he is a living mystic. All good film directors are living mystics.
Christoph is a figure.
Yeah, and Christoph, Chris, Christ, yeah. False Christ. Truth. First problem is there's not truth here. There's no truth. This is all deception. Wake up. This is all deception. Things are not as they appear.
For the understood, our connection. Only we can only connect.
Only connect. This is a fake world we live in, people are saying. First of all, audience, wake up. This, you are living in a lie. And you are even funding it and feeling it. We are in a lie. This paradox that our culture is promised.
He threw himself into politics having this colony in his prior life, lost his sight in conflict with the God of the Iranians.
No physical blind much is like they don't win them.
And it was only after he lost his sight that he threw himself.
So one of the things, I think you're getting on the same thing, is one of the things you have to wake up, the second thing is you've got to be willing to endure suffering. Willing to suffer the truth that you're going to see when you lift up the lid of the rock and look at the underbelly of the rock. Truman, he's like us. He wants to wake up to this reality. He'll see scenes where there's mistakes and he follows these people or he sees something he goes and the back of the elevator is open and it's not going to sit. He's not supposed to see that, you know. Then they have to rewrite the script. It's kind of like him running into his dad. He runs out of the script. They had to rewrite his mother. But we didn't control him. He's blind. I don't feel bad about it. When we've all been trying to relate to the family, our parents used to do it for their purpose. It was a primal wound spark. We had to wake up to the lie of those values we never had. Every woman in this room, Daddy told her, I'll lay you out at 9 to 10, that if you were the true woman in that life, not that stupid wife of hers. And every boy in this family, living in his family, his mother said, you were the real woman, not that jerk. The way we got. People are good. The way we got absorbed in dark ways and deception happened. And an obligation to maintain that deception. And it's hard to undo those deceptions. One of the things I do is that book we mentioned earlier, my parents. The analysis, one of the things our analysis is that we really need to bring what we get from our families and our practical reality. And I've been stunned by the degree that a 45-year-old man or woman, if I can talk about this 45-year-old, What else does Peter worship get back to you? The result is something. What you said?
Well, as the passing movie, I just don't give up.
Don't give up. Persevere. Managed care, another capitalist managed care that says if you can't get well in 3 sessions of grief solution focused therapy, we're not going to pay anymore. You can't solve your problems with grief. The lie is it takes time. I sat in brain research seminar last Saturday, and the fascinating brain information I'm getting. And you know, we are geared to be chasing sensory factors on the serendipity function. And primitive anxiety parts of the brain, the arousal parts, the amygdala and the hippocampus, the hypothalamus, the alarm parts, there's rich neural pathways to wake us up, loading up to our cerebral cortex, the upper cortex, the wake us up, that settle the world around, wake us up, so that we can run away or kill the sacred type. Evolutionarily, there's very few pathways to go back in to calm down that anxious arousal. So if you have any kind of damage, were raised in an alarming childhood or in an alarming culture like that, where anxiety bells are going off all the time, to unlearn them and to create pathways that don't exist is very key. You're going to have to go over. Maybe you've been in therapy. You seem like it never ends. The Acoustic speaks pretty in loop. It's like we're in the same night. Over and over. 1 year, 2 years, 14 years for me. I still don't get it. It's a little bit better. I can self-calm a little bit. But it takes a lot of work. You have to persevere. You have to want to love the soul so much. That's one of the statements. If we did these three images of Beatrice or Dionysus, and we have to believe that we yearn for that is the truth of the divine will willing to lay down our lives for. And truly, clearly, is working on the heat to lay down. He does. I won't tell you how. He's willing to even sacrifice his life. That's the ultimate. And Sophia will guide us in sleeping. I'm not suggesting that in all cultural moments that the image of the divine is always feminine, but in the late patriarchy, the angry old guy in the sky stuff doesn't do it anymore. The repressed feminine, you're almost right, the feminine is repressed. And in our age, over and over again, the graphic, the literary, particularly the visual art, the divinity is always here. Almost invariably. It's Shekinah, the dark shore-like woman of the Old Testament, or Sophia in the Judeo-Christian one. She comes to us over and over again. She is the God. And it is her eyes of mercy and beauty and good and connection with our ego and our acceding to that connection and getting on fire with it that will lead us out of the suffering. Lead us to the truth, to the persevering one. And there's a fourth element suggested in this thing that I'm seeing as part of the hell that we have to go through to get back to paradise. There's something missing in the picture. What is it suggesting to this? Of all things that are missing, what human thing is missing in this thing? The father of hermaphroditic balance. The
father loves the feminine and the child is the innocent. The father is either angry or absent or dead or gone. And fathers have got to be found in their mind and soul. And Sophia knows where the fathers are there. She knows where the fathers are there. My father was a depressed, earnest man all his life. During his days, he was an attorney and hated his profession and minded the Japanese. And never got the attention of those offices. I remember coming home when I was a kid, and I knew there was trouble in the city, and my dad's plate was turned upside down. But he said, bang, it pops down. Your father, down on the road, too young for his mother called, and they're missing an income, and your father went away for 2 weeks. He won't be back. Pick up one. Her rage, her disturbed, her fear. Then my dad would come home and she would be waiting. Well, he died. One of my father's dead. For a month, my mother called me to drink. I'm a drinker. She was like, I'm a weird son. But when she started having weird dreams,
probably have to hit play. Thank you.
Lisa. Thank you.
We're going to close this real quickly. Where did Vincent Ward say the words of ego?
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.